Okay, welcome. I'm Charles.
I'm Judy.
This is Judy. Our experience in ministry has been 17 years in congregational ministry, and then we've been at ACU since 1988, so another 17 years working in the context of ACU as our base of ministry. But working with couples in ministry a lot through a ministry called Minister Support Network. And Judy has a ministry as a school counselor at Abilene High School. What we propose to offer in these two sessions, and they are not repeats, they are sequel, is we want to offer some perspectives from our experience and other people's experience about the challenges that we face, that church leaders' spouses face. And obviously, if a church leader's spouse faces challenges, that means the couple does. And so we want to approach it from that perspective. The spouses personally, but the couples in leadership together. The first session will focus on those challenges. The second session this afternoon will be aimed at offering some strategies for not only surviving, but thriving. For doing this ministry of leadership with joy. And that's something that we believe is possible, and it's the way it can be and should be. What we'd like to do is to begin by sharing with you a story. It's a story that is told by a Jewish rabbi. He died several years ago. His name was Edwin Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. If you listen to this story and you would be interested in having a copy of this story and a number of others that he wrote, I suggested that they provide copies of the book from which this is taken on the book tables out here, and I frankly didn't check this morning to see if they're out there, but it's by Edwin Friedman, and this is from his book that's entitled Friedman's Fables. Okay, and it should be available. It is available from the publisher, both in printed form as a book and in an audio form as well. So obviously this is going to be an audio form. It's the first one. It's kind of his signature fable, and it's entitled The Bridge.
The Bridge.
Turn it up.
There was a man who had given much thought to what he wanted from life. He had experienced many moods and trials. He had experimented with different ways of living. And he had had his share of both success and failure. At last, he began to see clearly where he wanted to go. Diligently, he searched for the right opportunity. Sometimes he came close, only to be pushed away. Often he applied all his strength and imagination, only to find the path hopelessly blocked. And then at last it came. But the opportunity would not wait. It would be made available only for a short time. If it were seen that he was not committed, the opportunity would not come again. Eager to arrive, he started on his journey. With each step, he wanted to move faster. With each thought about his goal, his heart beat quicker. With each vision of what lay ahead, he found renewed vigor. Strength, which had left him since his early youth, returned, and desires, all kinds of desires, reawakened from their long dormant positions. Hurrying along, he came upon a bridge which crossed through the middle of a town. It had been built high above a river in order to protect it from the floods of spring. He started across. Then he noticed someone coming from the opposite direction. As they moved closer, it seemed as though the other were coming to greet him. He could see clearly, however, that he did not know this other, who was dressed similarly, except for something tied around his waist. When they were within hailing distance, he could see that what the other had about his waist was a rope. It was wrapped around him many times, and probably, if extended, would reach a length of 30 feet. The other began to uncurl the rope, and just as they were coming close, the stranger said, "Pardon me, would you be so kind as to hold the end a moment?" Surprised by this politely phrased but curious request, he agreed without a thought, reached out, and took it. "Thank you," said the other, who then added, "Two hands now, and remember, hold tight." Whereupon the other jumped off the bridge. Quickly, the free-falling body hurtled the distance of the rope's length, and from the bridge the man abruptly felt the pull. Instinctively, he held tight and was almost dragged over the side. He managed to brace himself against the edge, however, and after having caught his breath, looked down at the other dangling close to oblivion. "What are you trying to do?" he yelled. "Just hold tight," said the other. "This is ridiculous," the man thought, and began trying to haul the other in. He could not get the leverage, however. It was as though the weight of the other person and the length of the rope had been carefully calculated in advance, so that together they created a counterweight just beyond his strength to bring the other back to safety. "Why did you do this?" the man called out. "Remember," said the other, "if you let go, I will be lost." "But I cannot pull you up," the man cried. "I am your responsibility," said the other. "Well, I did not ask for it," the man said. "If you let go, I am lost." He began to look around for help, but there was no one. How long would he have to wait? Why did this happen to befall him now, just as he was on the true verge of success? He examined the side, searching for a place to tie the rope, some protrusion, perhaps, or maybe a hole in the boards. But the railing was unusually uniform in shape. There were no spaces between the boards. There was no way to get rid of this newfound burden, even temporarily. "What do you want?" he asked the other dangling below. "Just your help," the other answered. "How can I help? I cannot pull you in, and there is no place to tie the rope, so that I can go and find someone to help me help you." "I know that. Just hang on. That will be enough. Tie the rope around your waist. It will be easier." Fearing that his arms could not hold out much longer, he tied the rope around his waist. "Why did you do this?" he asked again. "Don't you see what you have done? What possible purpose could you have had in mind?" "Just remember," said the other, "my life is in your hands." What should he do? "If I let go, all my life I will know that I let this other die. If I stay, I risk losing my momentum towards my own long-sought-after salvation. Either way, this will haunt me forever." With ironic humor, he thought to die himself, instantly to jump off the bridge while still holding on. That would teach this fool. But he wanted to live, and to live life fully. "What a choice I have to make. How shall I ever decide?" As time went by, still no one came. The critical moment of decision was drawing near. To show his commitment to his own goals, he would have to continue on his journey now. It was almost already too late to arrive in time. But what a terrible choice to have to make! A new thought occurred to him. While he could not pull this other up solely by his own efforts, if the other would shorten the rope from his end by curling it around his waist again and again, together they could do it. Actually, the other could do it by himself, so long as he, standing on the bridge, kept it still and steady. "Now listen," he shouted down. "I think I know how to save you," and he explained his plan. But the other wasn't interested. "You mean you won't help? But I told you I cannot pull you up myself, and I don't think I can hang on much longer either." You must try, the other shouted back in tears. If you fail, I die. The point of decision had arrived. What should he do? My life or this other's? And then a new idea. A revelation, so new, in fact, it seemed heretical, so alien was it to his traditional way of thinking. I want you to listen carefully, he said, because I mean what I am about to say. I will not accept the position of choice for your life, only for my own. The position of choice for your life I hereby give back to you. What do you mean? The other asked, afraid. I mean simply, it's up to you. You decide which way this ends. I will become the counterweight. You do the pulling and bring yourself up. I will even tug a little from here. He began unwinding the rope from around his waist and braced himself anew against the side. You cannot mean what you say, the other shrieked. You would not be so selfish. I am your responsibility. What would be so important that you would let someone die? Do not do this to me. He waited a moment. There was no change in the tension of the rope. I accept your choice, he said at last, and freed his hands.
One of the challenges that we face as church leader families is that in the name of looking for or asking for help, there are numerous, maybe numberless, people that may not even be aware that they're doing it, but what they're doing is they're handing us the rope. And the expectation that they have is that we as leaders who are supposed to be people who care about saving people will save them in perhaps a way similar to what was described by this person who jumped off the bridge. And I think a lot of the expectation is that we are responsible for what happens to them more than they are. I think that we are called to roles of leadership because we are perceived at least to be responsible, conscientious, interested in helping other people, and that if the church calls us to leadership, then for some people the expectation is that that means that we are willing and able to accept responsibility for their lives more than they are for their own lives. That is a challenge. And frankly, Judy and I are both licensed counselors, and we both have scars from rope burn. We have heartburn too, but rope burn. And the only way that we have learned how to do something differently is by trying perhaps too much, too hard, too often to accept people's ropes and to try to over-function, basically, and to allow them to under-function. That is a challenge that we all face as leaders.
We've listed off these when we were brainstorming about what we wanted to share in this session.
And this is in the notebook.
Yeah, this the session one.
There's an outline.
And so they're not necessarily in any order of importance, just that they came to our thinking in this order. The second concept we wanted to visit with you about is confidentiality. To share or not to share. And I don't know very many elders' families that haven't dealt with this or ministry families that haven't dealt with this. As licensed professional counselors, we have a very strict code about confidentiality when dealing in counseling settings. And I think some of that does apply, but however, the information that the elder receives or the elder's wife receives or the minister receives is sacred. The information or the problems that a family might be experiencing or the tragedies. But one thing that we have, and I think every couple has to work this out in the way that's going to bless their marriage. I mean, ministry should never be a wedge between you. And so that's important, I think. But I also think we need to be very careful, loving, and cautious. And, there are some times when there are things that I'm thankful I don't know. But there are times when he needs to tell me things that I shouldn't know, but that I have to handle responsibly. And that's where the help of God comes in. Because I do feel like you sometimes, I think there's a reason that elders have and ministers are usually married, because the load is heavy. And I think sharing that load is also one of those callings and gifts. But, it's a very individual thing. And I think the spouses, you need to talk about how you want to handle that, the confidential information. Sometimes people will come to you and all they really want to do is just dump their problems on you. And, they go away and they think, well, I feel better. And you're about to faint from the load. There again is some, go back to story number one sometimes. But sometimes just being there to receive it is a gift you give to them. Just to be there to hear it and to reflect back what they've said to you, so that they can hear it in a way that maybe they will see it in a different way. Good judgment is very important. You want to comment?
Well, we realize that there are some situations in which confidentiality has to be waived because of the laws of the state. For instance, if there is any kind of a significant suspicion that a minor is being abused, that's not even a choice between keeping that confidential or disclosing that. In the state of Texas, I believe the latest timetable is you've got 48 hours to report it, and if you don't, you're liable. You can be prosecuted, and some church leaders have been prosecuted when it's then later learned that they knew that this abuse was going on and they kept hush-hush about it. If there is a felony, if there is high lethality in terms of the possibility of someone hurting themselves or someone else, you don't have a choice. And so in those situations, confidentiality is automatically waived because of other priority concerns and issues.
One other thing that I have found helpful in working with adolescents is often they will tell me things that they don't want me to tell, but they need to tell. Like, I don't want my mom to know this, but this is, this is what's going on. What I do is coach them and help them to tell themselves, to get it dealt with. Because the most loving thing is for those parents to be involved in this particular problem that's going on. So if they're going to find out eventually, immediately is better. And coming from you. So sometimes you're going to be a coach helping people talk to someone that they think they can't talk to.
That's been something that I've tried to do to keep me from being caught in a triangle between me and other elders or me and some other leaders like the ministers that may need to be involved in ministering to a situation. I am not going to be put into the position, if at all possible, in which someone tells me something and then says, you've got to keep this a secret. And that means that I've got a gag order. That means I can't collaborate with other church leaders, that I can't minister or access the other ministry resources to help this person. That's where I'm often the one that will, as Judy said, coach them to say, this needs to be told to the elders, and you're the one that needs to tell your own story, your own truth. You need to confess your own sins. You need to tell your own experience. And there are some situations, for instance, if there's an affair going on with a member of the staff or with another church leader, I'm not going to be put in the position, if at all possible, in which I have to be the one to disclose what's going on to the elders. I think they should. I think it's a part of their healing and recovery to tell their own truth. And there are some situations in which I'm going to say to them, I'm going to give you X amount of time. I'll even facilitate the conversation by arranging the meeting for you to tell the elders your own story, or at least one or two of the elders your story. But if you have not done it by the end of that time, then I will assume that means you have chosen for me to tell them. But we're not keeping this a secret. The one other thing I want to say about this confidentiality not being a wedge, I've been in situations in which in orienting people as nominees to serve as elders or as members of a search committee for a minister, where confidentiality is one of the priorities of people that serve in that group, I've had people say, well, then I'm not serving because my spouse and I share everything, and I'm not about to make this ministry the only wedge between us and the intimacy that we share as a couple. And so if you mean I can't even ask my spouse to help me process this or to coach me about the best way for me to minister in this situation, then you can have it. I think that's where couples have to negotiate that, and there may be some situations in which a couple that knows how and has learned how to handle confidentiality responsibly may decide we are going to share some things with each other and we're going to minister together in those situations.
Well, and there again, I just want to say personality, you know, we all have different personalities, and there are some personalities that when they get the information, it is like, I cannot keep it. It just would be such a rush for me to share this with somebody. You know, it's when that immature, this makes me important because I know this, gets in the way of the mature bearing the burden. And so I just want to call you to how sacred and how important it is to have confidential, to handle things confidentially. But on the other hand, be loving and caring with each other on it as well.
But it's okay to blab anything as long as it's a prayer request, right?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I know all of you have heard stories about prayer groups where somebody says, I need you to pray about this situation. And when they start telling you about the situation they want you to pray about, it is something that should never have been mentioned in a group of any sort. So just be careful and prayerful.
So many of our prayer groups are no ethics groups. And, you know, as one friend of mine said, well, I figure if we don't talk about people, that means we don't care about them.
As a joke.
Uh-uh. Yeah, she was being facetious. Just be careful about what Judy just mentioned about prayer groups. They're not for the purpose of holy gossip.
Okay, assisting without rescuing people in crisis.
Okay, the assisting without rescuing people that are in crisis. In our work with people that are in crisis, there is a kind of a model that I teach and use. It's basically a problem-solving model. It says the first thing you do is to make psychological contact, emotional contact, to build rapport and trust with that person. By genuinely, sincerely listening. The second thing you do is to explore the dimensions of the problem. And I use a kind of an acrostic, that there is a kind of a model that I go through that I just wish I could remember the sequence of it.
It would be great if you could. I can't believe you've forgotten. But if you're looking to me for help, you're out of luck.
Well, I'm trying to remember what it spells.
Give me a clue. Maybe I can remember.
Let's see. Basic. That's it. B-A-S-I-C. Okay. The B is for behavior, behavioral patterns. What are the behavioral patterns that this person is doing? Maybe they keep creating more of the same kind of consequences by perpetuating or repeating the same kinds of behaviors. We often say, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten. The second one is A for affect or affective, the emotional. What are the kinds of emotions that you're going through? And remember that emotions are the byproduct of the way we think and the way we act, what Tom Milholland would call cognitive behavioral therapy. S is for somatic, or the soma, the physical dimensions of our existence. Maybe this person could benefit from having a good, thorough physical. There may be something going on with them physically. The I is for interpersonal, the way that this person relates to other people, either individuals or groups of people like their family or some group at church. The C is for cognitive, and that gets back to how do they think? What are they telling themselves? What are their chronic beliefs and their ways of interpreting their own experience and other people's experience? I often add an S and make basic into basics. And the S that I often add in our context is for spiritual. What is going on in terms of our faith? Our understandings and our beliefs about God and about what it is for us to be human and to be made into and formed into the image of Christ. There comes a time then, as the third step in this model that I use, that is called examining possible solutions. Looking at a range of options that the person in crisis might consider as a way of dealing with this problem. Realizing that people are often in crisis because the way that they solve problems failed this time. In other words, I often say their fixer is broken. And then the fourth step is to assist them in taking action. And that's where many of us as caring Christian helpers, I think, really get ourselves into some troubled waters and cross over some healthy boundary lines. Because our first instinct is that we should rescue people. That is, that we should take charge of their lives like this guy that jumped off the bridge wanted his helper to do. That is only appropriate, in my understanding, when lethality is truly high. That is, when someone is likely to be hurt physically. That someone may take their own life or the life of someone else. Or that someone physically is in trouble because of the symptoms that they're showing. If lethality is high, then taking charge and assuming the responsibility for the intervention at that point may be appropriate. It often is. The problem that I think we have as church leaders is we assume that every problem is lethal. And the truth is, it is the minority of the problems that we're asked to intervene in that are truly lethal. Judy's dad used to say to our sons when they were small and young that if they fell and scratched their knee and were whining or crying about it, Floyd would say, "Well, do you think it'll get better before you get married?" And it kind of put things into perspective that this is probably not going to kill you. I don't mean to say that we ought to be flippant, but I think there is a place to be realistic and even playful with people about the severity of the kind of problem that they're dealing with, that this probably is not lethal. I've had teachers who have said anything that is mentionable is manageable. If you can talk about it, you can deal with it. If you can't talk about it, it will control you.
And I think it's very comforting to me to know that when somebody comes to me with a problem, to think in my mind, you know what, this person has within them what they need to deal with this. I don't have to be the one to solve this. I'm grateful that I get to assist them in solving it. Because it, you know, when you take the rope, it's like he was saying, the rope burn and the hanging on and your arms start to wobble and you know, then you lose all perspective of truly helping because you're just trying to survive yourself.
And really what happens there is we underestimate, as Judy was saying, the resources that they have and that only they have. And we also overestimate the resources that we have and the responsibility that we can have for assisting them, for solving their problems. The truth is, we don't have enough resources to compare to the resources that they have or that are available to them in the network of the church or of the community, as well as within their own experience and power. So I would say we need to assist them. Yes, we can help them, but that is very different from taking over the responsibility for their life, their choices, and the consequences of those choices. Can't do it. Shouldn't do it. And I guarantee you, if we keep doing that, we will wear out and we probably will say, I can't keep doing this leadership. Or when the elder selection process comes around, we'll say, you got to be kidding. I can't do that.
That's a good segue to triangles.
Okay, triangles. Triangles are a kind of an immediate reaction to anxiety in relationships. That when one of us, if I'm anxious about another person, they're probably the last person on earth that I'm going to talk to about that discomfort that I may have. Instead, our tendency is that A doesn't talk to B, A talks to C about B, which does two things. It probably means that it will reinforce or extend that pattern of behavior because it never gets addressed. If anything, it gets reinforced. And the second thing is, it means that the possibility of that behavior pattern changing is reduced because, once again, it's working at avoiding dealing with the problem. It keeps us from addressing the problem. We never name the elephant that's in the room.
And when somebody brings you a problem, if they've been hurt, the only way they have to interpret that is their way. So I know often when parents will call me about something that happened in the teacher's classroom, and the only side they've heard of that is their child. My child never lies. No, but your child sure does know how to survive. And survival means I'm going to tell my interpretation of this story. And I often, the first thing I say when I get those calls is, and what did the teacher say when you talked to her or him? And of course the answer is, well, I haven't talked to that person. And so, you know, you just resist that. You resist talking to the person that could help you, but sometimes the information, even though it's truthful, it's told from a very skewed perspective.
One of the first things that happened when I became an elder for the first time several years ago was that all of us who were about to be presented to the church as candidates, and by the way, that's the time that this needs to be addressed, not after you've already been selected. I think it needs to be during an orientation after you've been nominated, but before you have been presented to the church as a candidate. We were told two things that you need to learn immediately as responses because this will come up. If anyone comes to you with a complaint about another church leader, elder or minister, your first response is to be the one that Judy mentioned. Well, what did he or she say when you went and talked to them about it? And you know that over 90% of the time, they haven't. And they will have excuses. I'm not as good with words as they are. I'm intimidated. It won't do any good. Whatever. And you know that because? No. That's what you fear. All right. The second response that I was taught to make was, well, do you want to arrange to visit with that person by yourself, or would you like for me to assist you in that? And that's to keep this triangle mess from happening. When I work with a church that's in conflict, it has an interconnected chain or web of triangles. And one of the major things that we have to do to help them deal with conflict is to cut the triangles out and make them go A to B instead of A to C.
I think this is one of the occupational hazards. I think it's just, you know, when somebody comes to you, your first response is to try to fix it instead of backing off and trying to let them fix it. It's just kind of the nature of the problem. The next one is handling criticism of my spouse, which, of course, I can't speak to because my spouse has never been criticized.
Sure.
Just a little joke.
Yeah.
To me, this is, well, first let me just be confessional here. I'm not very good at this. My first response is to just go, you know, blow up their house or something. But I know that's not the loving thing to do.
I kind of like it.
one of the things that that I've learned through the years, though, is, you know, I care about him. I love him more than anyone else loves him, and I understand him, and I know where his heart is, so I know the good intentions that he has. So when I hear criticism, of course, the first thing I want to do is just go fly off the handle and say, how could they be so stupid? But you know what? Criticism is an opportunity, and it truly is. Eddie Sharp, our minister at University in Abilene, says, you know, sometimes those people that love you a lot don't always tell you the truth, but your critics will. There will be a grain of truth in there somewhere if you can be mature enough to see it and learn from it. And also, that triangle concept comes in, too. When your spouse is criticized, you need to back up and say, how are you going to deal with this? I know you can deal with this. I believe in you. I trust you. You can handle this. You're a big boy, you know. And I think the loving thing to do is to support and encourage and not overreact. That's easy to say. Everybody handles criticism in the same way. When you're criticized, you go to the defensive every time. I mean, that is a physiological thing. We're trained that way. When somebody comes at you, your defenses come up to protect yourself. Here's the thing, though. The mature person can back up and then can have a mature response. Think it through. Let your thinking part of your brain take over. You know, that defensive part of your brain protects and defends. But you can count to 10, take a deep breath, walk around the block, let that thinking part of your brain come in, and then handle it in a mature Christian way. That's the huge challenge, I think. But because especially when your intentions and your heart are in the right place, and then you get criticized or put down for the things that you know were loving and caring in intent, but then somebody criticizes it or assaults it, then it's very difficult. I read somewhere that the Zen master said, it's just as sinful to take offense as it is to give offense. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? That just basically means you have to be a mature person and not get offended, but that's hard. It's very hard. And the thing about anger, when you're angry and you're operating out of your anger mode, you know, the angrier you get, the angrier you are, the angrier you are. You know, years ago that when we were taught how to work with very angry adolescents or children, we would let them hit things and bounce on things. Well, now they're saying you need to retrain the brain. You need them to learn calmer ways of dealing with it. And the more you suppress that anger and the more you reroute that anger, the calmer and the more able to cope you become. So I've got a handout I'll give to you all that I got from a workshop that I attend. It's just a little acrostic thing. HEALS is the word, and it's how to manage your anger. At the first sign of just that red rage anger you get, think of the word healing flashing in your brain. Then explain to yourself, this may be while you're walking around the block taking your deep breaths, explain to yourself what is the fear, what is the core feeling that you have in there, that you, the hurt that you're feeling, why is this hurting so much and why are you so angry? And then the next thing is apply self-compassion. Acknowledge the deepest feeling that you have and dispute the wrong assumptions. They don't know me, they don't understand me. And then love yourself. Remind yourself of your value, your importance, reject the false beliefs about yourself, and then S is sit down and solve this problem. Come up with alternatives on dealing with it. That's
one of the things we've tried to do. Both of our sons are ministers. They're here today. They're both big guys. One 6'4", the other 6'5". If I'm going in to work with a church that's having a severe conflict and they've asked me to intervene, I like to take John and Ben with me. Stand one on either side.
Because they're both little kind of teddy bears.
Make a little statement that says, now we are going to be nice here, aren't we? Well, one thing that we've had to do with them is we've had to say, look, we're not going to be there to protect you or defend you. and you will be hurt in ministry. That's part of it. But rather than discount you by assuming that you're going to need us there to defend you or protect you, we'd rather teach you what I call ministerial karate. Okay? Well, I think there is church leader and church leader family karate. That means that we empower and equip our family about how we're going to deal with criticism rather than be such a sensitive, fragile, delicate people that will be devastated by the criticism that we know is going to come.
When a parent says to me, but my child is so sensitive, what I hear is, I am so sensitive.
Well, what they say is, my child is so sensitive.
Well, what is it? And it's a discount. Okay, we need to go. When are we supposed to be done?
11:45.
Okay. Finding identity apart from the leader's spouse. You know, there's all different ways of defining how you minister as a couple and how you define yourself as the wife of a church leader or a husband of a church leader now that we have. I can't find my notes. There they are. I do think, you know, like in my life and in our life, I've been a person that has a profession. I've been a high school counselor many years, a middle school counselor, elementary counselor. I actually started teaching in elementary school and have been a counselor through the years. And it has worked very well for us. I mean, I've always been very supportive, and that's been my choice as how I serve in the family. And my leadership is, I'm supportive. I believe so strongly in the church. Nothing has ever been more important in my life than the church and then serving God. That's my calling. But I work in some of the frontline ministries of, as my son calls it, in a public school, and I'm very thankful for the opportunities I have to minister, and I know many of you are in those kinds of roles, but many of you are very, very collaborative and are co-elders and co-ministers with your husbands, most of you are women, so please excuse me if I don't have the gender right when I'm talking to you. But I think your calling, I think it's important that the two of you work together on how you choose to define the roles. I think sometimes I've seen it situations where the elder's wife is the dominant leader in the family, and that has worked well. The elder is more quiet, but the elder's wife knows how to get things done, and she's involved, or the minister's wife, and he supports her in her active roles. But then there again, those boundaries are important. You know, how we define those boundaries. I know the first time that Charles was nominated to be an elder, my first response to this was, well, that's great. You just go right ahead. I'm not going to, you know, that doesn't fit me, and that doesn't, you're the one. But that's not realistic. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you are a couple, and you bring to this role your strengths as a couple. And so, but it's defined in so many different ways, how you choose to have your role. And if you find yourself being very frustrated, then you probably need to sit down as a couple to talk out what it is you know, that's finding frustration.
I think it's important, too, to realize that you are both leaders, and in the leader selection process, both of you are credibility people, or neither one of you would be asked to serve. I think it's also important to remember that it's not that you are two partial people and together you make one whole person. I think it's much truer to recognize that you are both whole people. and you are partners, and there is a kind of a synergy and a collaborative partnership between the two of you that's even stronger than having two partial or pieces of people that together just make one.
And I do think that as a couple, you just really need the time to work together. I know you don't have to be the perfect couple. I mean, people think, well, we're, you know, in this role, so we have, I mean, let's face it, I read a book recently that anger is not a predictor of a troubled marriage. In fact, anger is
that's good to know.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
If it escalates and it gets real, contentious, then that's a different story. But, you know, you've been with couples where, you know, you're talking and one of them says, would you let me finish? Oh, finish. I mean, you know, that's a totally different thing than bringing out all of the luggage from, well, your parents were, you're just like your father, blah, blah, blah. And you know, and then it gets real negative. But you know, as a couple, you can grow together and just be a normal couple. Infinite demands, finite resources, all this ties in together.
Yeah, if you look in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, when Jesus and the disciples are at the end of the day in a desolate place, and there are thousands of people, we call it in Scripture the feeding of the 5,000, other places say the feeding of the 4,000, other stories. But remember that Jesus has been teaching all day. They're far away from the community. They're in a desolate place. The people are tired and they're hungry. And here are all these thousands of eyes looking at the disciples. And basically they're looking at the disciples saying, we need you to feed us. That's what I call infinite demands. But Peter says what I think a lot of us as church leaders feel. He said, send them away, Lord. Let's tell these people it's time for them to go home. And Jesus says, no, not going to do it. Well, then what do you want us to do? Go to Sam's Wholesale Club and buy them out? Bulk supplies of cheese and other stuff and bring it back and try to feed them? And once again, Jesus says, no, I don't want you to try to minister to these people with resources that you don't have. What I want you to do is to take stock of the resources that you already have and give them to me. That's where the 5 loaves and the 2 fish surface. They're given to Jesus. He prays. They are multiplied. The multitude is fed, and as you know, there are leftovers. I think that we as church leaders find ourselves in that situation most of the time with what I call infinite demands for ministry and limited resources with which to minister. I think it's important that we not overwhelm ourselves either with the impossible extent of the demands or with the minimal extent of the resources. I think what's important is that we offer what we have and that we trust in the power of God to use what we have and what we give in ways that will minister to people much more than we can imagine. That's our job, to give what we've got and to trust that God will use it.
And the last one, caring for us, not just them. I'm just going to end with just a short little story. When you're, because you must love yourself and care for yourself and your family if you're going to be of any help to anyone. When you're on an airplane and the oxygen masks drop and you're with a child, what do they ask you to do? Put it on the child first or yourself? Because what good are you if you can't, to that child, if you can't breathe? So that's the end for me. Take care of yourself.
This afternoon we're going to offer some strategies that we have found to be valuable for helping church leader spouses or families not only survive but thrive. And so that'll be for later today. Thank you.
Let's pray.
We're going to close in prayer and then make a beeline downstairs to the fellowship hall for a barbecue lunch. Father, we thank you for the call to minister and even to lead your people in ministry. We pray that you would save us from the overwhelming challenges and from being intimidated by those, but that you would encourage us with your power that we can minister to others even as we're able to receive your ministry to us. Through Jesus we pray. Amen.